That's it. Hello and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. This is the place where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Brandon Rhodes, and we are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the challenge of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
We're covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, communications, and the internet. Roundly welcomed rainy days.
Yes. Yeah, it's raining for the first time in several weeks here in Portland, Oregon. And it wasn't one of those oppressive rains. I was thinking as I was going out to get our guest Ellie Blue's beverage for the afternoon, I went out on my bike just not 30 minutes ago, and it wasn't an oppressive rain. It wasn't one of those winter rains that drives and gets into your bones. It was actually refreshing and it sprinkles upon you like the fresh dew. So that was nice. and that's the weather from Portland. The news from Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
So this is actually it's somewhat unusual recording because we are doing this at 1 p.m., which usually it's later, either 2 p.m. or 7:30. But I actually woke up an hour before the show was slated to start. So I think got up at noon today. And
rough life being Brock.
It is. It really is. I just ordinarily, I was saying, I think to you, Brandon, that drinking at 1 o'clock is not really like I would do that. But
you have done that
when it's the equivalent of my usual like 6:30 a.m. That seems like a bad idea. It's a bad time to start. So I'm drinking a cup of coffee. Do you have coffee as well?
I do have coffee.
Okay, there we go. And our esteemed guest, Ellie Blue, is drinking iced tea.
Yes, thank you very much.
Ellie, thank you for joining us on the show. It's good to have you in.
Thanks for having me on. It's awesome to be here in the Sprocket Bat Cave.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and a bat cave it is. We're going to be talking a little bit later on about your dinner and bikes tour, about your many publications, and your perspectives on Portland as a place.
That's right.
In general, and for bikes, and that's all coming up. We've got some news headlines. Right now, I went to a party last night, which was great.
Good story.
That's right. It was my wife's coworker's birthday party, and so we went up there. We bicycled up the West Hills at like 8:30 p.m., and we got there, and people were there. People were dancing. There was karaoke to be had, and we got home at I think it was close to 2:30 last night. So a late night, anyways.
Well, yeah, it was good times. 9 miles, 10 miles of bicycling between party and here.
So. That's it. Yeah. How was your weekend,
we're
sir?
We're 9 miles from anything, though.
We are, very much so. We're out here on the edges of civilization.
That'll be our first spinoff podcast, 9 miles from anywhere. Good. I woke up with a head cold yesterday, but it turned out to be like one of the best days ever. We had we got a text from a friend, a neighbor, who said, hey, there's a free outdoor gear, not free.
That would be nice.
It's an outdoor gear sale in somebody's front yard. They had probably 60 pairs of boots, 40 jackets, tons of bags, all kinds of stuff, some wetsuits. So
nice. You've been wanting a wetsuit.
I did not buy a wetsuit. I feel like a fool. I wanted to get a wetsuit to raft the Johnson Creek.
Yeah, Ellie, are you familiar with Johnson Creek out here?
I am.
It's a toxic wasteland in some people's minds. It's not in fact entirely destroyed.
The salmon spawn in it, man. There are
That's
salmon
right.
that spawn like a third of a mile away from here.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
amazing.
But the perception publicly is that it's a dirty, dirty place.
Well, the nearest place you can look into it from here, you will see like a shopping cart and a couple tires.
That's right. But, and they've been there for a while.
How bad could those be?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Most of that stuff's washed down.
So yeah, that was great. We wound up, we got our neighbor to tag along, and we all were like way too giddy to be spending money. It was kind of embarrassing, but we got really good stuff for like a $200 jacket for $8.
And, that's impressive, sir.
And then we got another text message being like, hey, and my neighbor is selling these vegetable starts. So we like biked over to another neighbor's house, and she was just hanging out, I think already drunk. It was 1 o'clock.
There you go. So she went
just
the other route.
So ready to, yeah. She was so ready to show off. She had a whole really nice backyard, and like we aren't in a neighborhood where people always take care of their yards like ever the rest of Portland. But right, it was amazing. And she had she's been growing all these tomato starts for years now. She's got 27 varieties of tomatoes, two kinds of basil, all kinds of good stuff. So
Wow. Yeah,
it was amazing to be able to buy these things for a dollar each.
Wow. And so those are in our garden
right
now, then?
From a neighbor. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, our basil and two zucchinis, two cucumbers, and three tomato plants are all in there.
So. Nice, nice. Well, congratulations. I just realized that would be the point at which I could do the that thing to you.
Yeah, but it was just one of those like magical, like living local weekends.
That's lovely.
So, yeah.
No, you and gardens are kind of like me and transit lines. We have very very specific knowledge of those things.
Yeah, I'm like breathing heavily now and like getting really...
Well, that sounds like a good idea. It's nice that things just kind of pop up for sale. I'm curious about if a $200 jacket is being sold for $8. Like, how in the world is that a possible swap?
I feel like there must be a couple little flaws with it. Like, almost everything there had a like busted zipper or something.
Oh,
but
so this is like REI reject stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, good. Congratulations, sir. Good work.
Yes.
Yeah. We talked about Sunday Parkways last week. I guess I was fresh off of that when we taped our show. Ellie, did you do Sunday Parkways this time around?
I did, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
It's so magical. I've never seen so many people smiling all at once in my life as at Sunday Parkways.
Yeah. I made the observation, I think, last week that there are so many young children out on bicycles that you wouldn't usually see on the streets. So that was pretty entertaining.
And they're all saying really cute things. Like, Mommy, why are my legs not tired yet?
Because this is normal, dear.
Exactly.
Bicycling is okay to do. That's great. Yeah. Well, hey, should we hop into our news headlines?
Let's do it.
All right. Fantastic. Here it comes. This is local Portland band Hurt Bird.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. It circles around the city lights.
All right, first up from Urban Velo and The Telegraph. Graham Aubrey plans to break 100 miles an hour on a homemade bike.
Yeah, yeah. And the coolest part about this was the headline says the 100 mile per hour bike designed in the bath and made from an old saucepan. The old saucepan is, in fact, only I think only the part on which he rests his shoulders. But if you check this picture out, you can see Graham, I believe, resting on this bicycle that he's contrived, that he's built, and it's essentially a, would you call that a prone position, where he's
it's like a flipped forward recumbent.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it looks like the bottom half of a tall bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah, it almost looks like a gravity bike sort of thing.
Is he planking?
It's possible. This is
the
bicycling.
That joke is like a year late.
The bicycling equivalent of planking. Yeah, I'm still I'm confused by this because I don't know how he pedals. It looks like there's a chain ring up here, like next to his waist, and his legs are far behind him. Maybe this is not finished yet. Maybe there's still work to be done. Ellie, do you know anything about this?
I have never seen anything like this before. It's completely outlandish.
Even for Portlanders, we're like, shit, what is that?
Right, right. Well, he has one of those. He has like a stormtrooper helmet, basically. Not the regular stormtrooper, but like the admiral stormtroopers or whatever in the Star Wars films, where like the helmet goes down over your neck. It looks like the the idea is for it to be aerodynamic, so that the air doesn't eddy back where his hairline
ends. It's like
ends.
A skiing helmet.
Yeah. So, anyways, he's planning on making this contraption travel at 100 miles an hour, which is that'll be breaking, I think, the land speed record for a human powered vehicle, which is kind of exciting.
That's crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
Sounds horrifying.
Yeah, and Mr. Aubrey is, he's 46 years old. I believe he was the subject, if I'm not mistaken, in this article, he was the subject of a film called The Flying Scotsman, 2006 is when that came out. He's a former professional bicycling racer. And it's pretty interesting anyway. So he's been kind of cannibalizing parts and things and putting this
machine.
When
is he going to do this?
I don't know. It's going to happen in Nevada, if I understand correctly. I saw a piece of that as I was reading through it. Yeah. In 1993, he did break the record for distance traveled in 1 hour on a self-made bike. That, amongst other parts,
what was it? How far?
Contained the bearings of an old washing machine. It doesn't actually say. That seems like, yeah, it seems like the Telegraph would be, you know.
What's the fastest you've gone, Brock?
Fastest I've gone? I think... It's hard to say. I remember 2 years back, I took a tour out into the Columbia Gorge heading for Idaho, And when I got to, what is it, the Butte out there, there's a state park, and it's all deserty. There's a downhill stretch. I had a tailwind coming up the Columbia River from the ocean. And that, I don't actually have a speedometer nor a tachometer on my bicycle, so I can't say for sure. But I would suspect that I was probably upwards of 40 miles an hour with all of my panniers, all of my gear, my backpacker guitar strapped on the back and everything. And so me just holding on and going, oh shit, this is fun. So, yeah, I think that's probably, but I don't know exactly how fast.
How about you, Ellie?
Yeah. Do you have any idea?
I have no idea how fast I've gone. I'm kind of a wuss when it comes to going downhill fast. But there is a guy who used to live in Portland, Brian. Do you remember him? He made the like RV bikes.
Oh, yeah.
The giant silver things.
And we've got a trailer of his.
Oh, cool.
We do.
Well, do you know about his flywheel design?
No.
He's a mechanical genius, and he's designed this flywheel that he says can get him up to 60 or 70 miles an hour going uphill on one of his crazy RV bikes.
Wow.
And I haven't witnessed it, but he can't, you know, I mean, he can't market it, and he's so scared that somebody will steal the technology from him that he just doesn't make them.
And he's not in Portland anymore?
I don't know where he is. I don't think he was very happy in Portland. But
yeah, we haven't seen him for a while. We should back up maybe and just explain the context around this, because this guy is pretty cool. I feel like we've probably talked about him at some point on the show before, but Brian... also, I think when we met him, he called himself Rastaman, which he's got the full head of dreads.
Pretty much what everybody else called him.
Yeah, yeah. But he made these two-wheeled RVs out of whatever he could find, aluminum sheets and bracing and all that. And he had an insulated compartment in which he slept and all of his belongings were
kept.
It was
the ultimate tiny house.
It was, yeah, on wheels. And it was all silver. It was kind of this futuristic metallic looking sort of thing. I remember I saw it up on Marine Drive one time when I was bicycling into work. He was probably staying out there for a bit. It had been parked in front of City Bikes when we saw it in 2006, 7, something like that. Yeah, but it's just a fantastic contraption, and the guy is a genius. So I didn't realize there was a flywheel with this, because a flywheel,
what the hell is a flywheel?
No idea what a flywheel is. Science fiction.
But he sure did. Yeah, exactly. It's pure magic.
Right. I'm not entirely mechanically adept at describing these sorts of things, but I'm guessing a flywheel, I think, is similar to someone... one of our
listeners. We're going to get letters about this.
I'm sure we will. Please do. That's thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. There was a guy who sent in a Science Friday video from NPR, and there was a guy building a bike with a flywheel that helped you, I guess, maintain your momentum. So as you're pedaling, the flywheel is this heavy disc that turns, and the turning momentum will sustain itself even when you stop the bike. And so that turning momentum can help you restart. Apparently, you can harness the energy from this flywheel So once you've put your force into the pedal stroke, that force stays with you.
It's an energy sink, sort of like how
turbines
work. Turbines, sure. Magic. Yeah.
So it's kind
magic
of like
cars.
That. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, just the idea that was there. I didn't even know that was a part of his design. So yeah, that's pretty great. So anyways, we should put a link up to some photos of that. But good
we'll
times.
Google Brian Rastaman Portland.
Definitely, yeah.
All right, next up, by way of sightline.org. 26 innovative ways to store your bike.
Yeah, this was something 26. That came from the bike. From the Bike Portland News Roundup, either this week or last week. And just going through the pictures, there's not probably too much to say other than there are lots of different ways to keep your bike handy. I like this first one here. The first two are like old boxes converted with a little notch so that you can hang your top tube there and keep your bike on the wall.
Keep scrolling. This will be Brock and Brandon and Ellie look at the internet.
Right. Similar to our usual, our regular feature now, Brock and Brandon watch YouTube.
Yeah.
And comment thereon. There's a couple of shed ideas. These bicycle racks, it's the one that you kind of nose your front wheel into. We all know. And I think, Ellie, did you have a photo stream that you had put up recently of ways not to lock your bike?
Yes, I did.
That's a great idea.
That was actually Caroline Paquette's idea. She makes the little package cycling caps.
Oh,
and
she
started sending me. She actually started the Flickr group to put in badly locked bikes. And many of them are... do feature, what are they called, wheel bender racks?
Right.
Where you put your front wheel in and then you abandon it after it bends in half.
Yeah, that's something that happens in Boston all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those things are not necessarily so useful for securing your bike, but if you want something to hold your bike up, especially if it doesn't have a kickstand, that's it's actually a decent way to go. That's the kind I lock my bike to every day, but I don't actually put it into the slots where the wheels are supposed to go. I lock it to the side.
That's because you got to get the frame.
Because, yes, and because it's a heavy, it's just a heavy piece of metal that I can affix to my bike to keep it, make it harder to steal.
Yep.
And then, of course, there's always just the good tarp to the fence method there. So many different ways. These, hanging the bike on the wall with the little cable chain to secure every part of the bike, there was one of those at the EcoTrust building I was at in downtown Portland the other month, and I was impressed actually by that system. I always thought like this is too complicated, but now that I've been using a kryptonite cable to secure my Brooks saddle to the rest of my bike so that it doesn't go missing again, I've been learning how to work those things. And all you have to do is bring your lock. And you've got the hook, which you hang the front wheel from, and then you've got the cable attached that goes through the various other parts of the bike. So that there's
great
all
idea.
Kinds, yeah. So
cool.
We could spend a lot more time looking
people
at pictures.
People are going to be bored out of their
mind.
I would
imagine so. So anyways.
Bike Portland has a story after a... This
is the sad news.
Yeah. After a fatal crash downtown, hundreds gathered to honor Catherine Rickson.
Yeah, and this happened just recently, just this last week. It was what ended up being a fatal collision. She didn't die on the site, I believe. She was taken away by ambulance, but died later that night. The response from the bicycling community around this was actually pretty impressive. There was a lot happening on social media, people talking about it quite a bit, and then folks showing up in force to make known that this was a sad thing. This was a real loss, and it's kind of standing in solidarity, especially with her family who remain and all of that. Apparently, it was a semi truck apparently that was doing one of those right hook maneuvers, and apparently they collided at that point. So. It's sad. Every time it happens, it's sad. I remember a couple of years ago, there were like two or three that happened right in a row. And it's just, I kind of wish we could be at a point where this wasn't necessarily the case, that this wasn't happening. But from time to time, it still does.
Yeah. So. I mean, whenever you've got giant chunks of metal moving around.
Right.
Eventually, people get hit.
Definitely. One of the signs that people had made, there were a big number of them, but this one here, designed for highways, not downtown, was one of the one of the signs that people were flying the other day. And that
on,
was
a, on a semi-truck.
On a semi-truck, yeah. Yeah. Just saying, this these things are too big to be moving around downtown. Ellie, do you have any insight into this event, the incident, or the aftermath?
I mean, it's definitely been on my mind a lot lately. It's a horrible tragedy, and it always really hits home when somebody dies on what especially is supposed to be a safely designed street. I mean, interestingly enough, I had just been thinking about that street when I found out about the news of the tragedy. A friend of mine wrote a blog post about the frequency of bullying bicyclists on the internet especially, but also on the streets, and how there's really a cultural movement right now to stop bullying. But on some of the very blogs that are dedicated to this, like feminist blogs, for instance, anytime there's any mention of bicycling, there will be all these like very hateful and kind of violent threats made.
Right.
And I was thinking about that street in particular because that's one where I often, that's one of the streets where I'm most often yelled at, honked at, cursed at, and violently threatened. And it's because I don't ride in the bike lane there. And it's because of two points of conflict, including the one where Catherine Rickson was when she died, which just seem like I just want to stay out of them. So I take the lane, and the lights are timed for 13 miles an hour, which is bike speed. So there's no reason not to take the lane. I'm not holding anybody up. I'm not.
Right.
But people yell at me, even people on bikes yell at me to get in the bike lane. People in cars yell at me much less politely to get in the bike lane. And I don't, but I sometimes I do ride in the bike lane just because I don't feel like being hassled that day. And
right.
Now, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people who don't like bike lanes and are taking that as a reason to say, get rid of them all, get rid of the bike boxes, which is not, but that particular stretch of street is badly designed.
Which street was it?
This is 3rd and Madison downtown.
Yeah,
Southwest.
So Southwest Madison. It's when you're like, say, if you're going from the Portland Building or City Hall mm-hmm. to get on the Hawthorne Bridge mm-hmm. to go.
Oh yeah, yeah.
To okay. the east side of the river.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's two places where people in cars are supposed to turn right. Right where people and bikes are supposed to go straight.
Right.
And they're marked with, they're well marked with green paint, but that does not always mean that people see you.
Yeah, and bike boxes are, I think they're a great idea, but it's one of those, the downside of infrastructure is that, especially when things are new, you know, if you're in a vehicle and you're driving, it can be hard sometimes to know, you know, what your responsibilities are, what the legality is, and so, anyways.
And I think the bike boxes work really well in places where people in cars can't turn right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what they're for, but
we've
misapplied them in some places. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they're great because they're like a giant billboard saying bikes belong on the road here, but then they also, I think, are not always the right tool for the job. Sort of like sharrows. They're mm-hmm. not always the tool for the job, even though they're very popular.
You can't design your way to perfect safety.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to get the giant trucks off third.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the eliminating the trailer based trucks from downtown, like you could still have the Charlie's trucks and things like that go through and have the Charlie's produce.
Oh right,
yeah, like it's attached as part, but it doesn't pivot.
One of those big box trucks.
Yeah,
yeah,
a big box truck that isn't pivoty thing.
Right. Even those are
non-trailer based. How about
that? Yeah. Even those are pretty big though, is the thing. Like it's just,
well, but you have to get food and office supplies to downtown places. And
that
so we
do.
Can have a robustly competitive bicycle option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beeline has been doing some great things
about
that. I'm very impressed with what they've come up with. Beeline cargo delivery is the cargo tricycles that roll around town and deliver things. And, I think they delivered the office supplies for the city of Portland, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. But yeah,
and I mean, we could retool our entire freight system, and other places have done this. Like in Japan, for instance, you have the giant depots on the edge of town off the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
So large trucks never come into the city. They drop things off, and then smaller trucks make
it's exactly what I'm suggesting is like, the produce center is on like Swan Island,
mm-hmm.
or is that it?
I don't know.
The industrial area. A lot of those are there, and then smaller trucks go in. So all the little grocery stores that are on the east side are fed by that, but usually smaller trucks.
Yeah. And you could actually create more jobs that way because mm-hmm. you would have to have more trucks, but we'll see if we get there.
Well, our memories and condolences go out to the surviving family, those who are close to Catherine, and the bicycle community at large. This is always, again, it's an incident that can't take lightly, and we feel it deeply. So, yeah.
Next up, also by way of Bike Portland, animation shows the growth of Portland's bike infrastructure over time. Ooh, I love animated GIFs.
Yeah, have you seen this one yet?
No.
I'm going to see if I can increase the size so it's easier for everyone to
Ooh.
Check out. This is, I'm trying to remember who it was that was, that created this.
Spencer Boomhauer,
that is the guy. Okay, yeah. I think he's an occasional Sprocket listener. I don't know if he's listening now, but...
Hi, Spencer.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. He's up to some cool stuff. And this map that he's created, anyways, was basically... it's kind of like watching an ant farm develop. It's all the lines on the map on Portland's cityscape grid. Try and say that again.
Nope.
all the lines just showing where the infrastructure is. So this is before 1980. It's starting now. And you can just see them growing, the lines kind of crossing town. And,
that's a great animation.
Definitely, yeah. It is interesting that even in the late 90s, there's not that much. 1999 and then 2002, I think Logan said that 2002 was the year of destiny. And you can kind of see it filling in just exponentially at that point. So anyways, it's super cool animation. It's really, really cool stuff.
Yep.
And it's a GIF, so you can post that anywhere on the internet, and people will be able to see its motion,
regardless of their platform.
That's right, simplicity,
okay.
Folks. It's also available on Vimeo, apparently, if you'd like to pause it. So, thanks to Jonathan Moss for that. Yeah, Jonathan also actually on this post that we're linking to put a good number of thoughts down as well, just about infrastructure in general. So, there's that.
And finally, by way of Transportland, map of the disaster relief trials route released.
And Ellie, have you heard about the disaster relief trials coming up?
I am so excited for the disaster relief trials coming up.
This is
going to
be, yes. Yeah, this it's a
Only in Portland are we thrilled about disaster or anything, but here we go.
Right.
Well, and the nice thing is, let's see. Oh, this, I'm sorry. This is the overview post here. There are some fantastic photos of bullets loaded with emergency relief supplies. I'm going to go back and see if I can navigate to the larger map so that people can look.
Are you going to be participating?
I hope to be. I thought that I was on the list, but I was just informed that I was on a wait list. But yes, I'll hopefully be participating with my extra cycle and 6-foot-long bamboo trailer made by Adam George.
Oh, nice. There's only one bamboo trailer maker here in town, is that right?
I believe there are two, actually.
Oh, okay. Because I think we had Lance Poehler on sometime last summer, and he also was pulling a bamboo trailer when we met him at the Bowie versus Prince ride for Pedalpalooza 2011. So, yeah, there's some fantastic trailer
solutions.
Has all
of the Pedalpalooza schedule been released?
People are still adding to it. I believe it's open until the 30th, and then it will be edited for print.
But right.
I have a ride to get on there, so hopefully.
Oh, there you go. Which one are you leading?
Megan Sinnott and I will be leading another ride to the Portland airport as part of our business PDX by bike to show people how easy it is to get to the airport.
There we go.
And there's secure bicycle parking and all that.
Apparently, there has never been a bicycle stolen from the airport. They have one that's been there for 3 years. It'll be 4 years now.
Really?
That they like to show off.
Really?
Don't take that as a dare, anybody.
All right. That's kind of similar to when I was in college in the dormitory that I lived in. There was a coat closet in the hallway. And in that closet was stapled a Taco Bell burrito that had been there, allegedly, for 10 years.
Oh, college.
Yes, yes. And on top of that, young single men living in college. It's a bad, bad combination.
That is depravity.
But that's fascinating to me that you could have a bicycle locked up. And it's locked up, I assume. It's not just sitting free.
Yeah, it's locked up with a cable lock. It used to have a bucket on it that had some rain gear in it, and after 2 or 3 years, that disappeared. But the bike is still there and gathering dust.
And I suppose you could assume that it's kind of free pickings after 2 years if the rain gear has not gone displaced. Probably someone forgot about it.
Yeah.
Not that we advocate stealing, but it's like curating your fridge at work to see who's left their lunch behind and when it's okay to eat that.
But the bike still has all its parts. I mean, you could probably pump up the tires and ride it away.
True enough.
So it's just there as a testament to airport security, I guess.
Nice. So will this ride be featuring that at some part? Will you be stopping by and saying, this bicycle has in fact been here? It's an installation at this point.
Hopefully it's still
there.
Put
a votive candle next to it.
That's a whole shrine. Yeah. So the route here, it looks like they've actually changed a bit of the routing since I looked at this map not too long ago. But they're going to be going all through Northeast Portland. And basically the idea is there's a super earthquake that's predicted at some point in the Pacific Northwest to occur. And the idea behind the disaster relief trial is that there may well be places where vehicles and traditional emergency responders cannot access. Roadways may be fucked. Is the technical term, I think.
Yes.
And so you may have a situation in which you need to get these supplies from one place to another, but you can't do it with four wheels. So all these awesome cargo bikes exist here in Portland. Everyone has one. Ellie has one. I have one.
Have one.
And basically the idea is to see kind of a friendly competition, how we could get these supplies from one place to another. So, it looks like it's going to go down kind of around the airport. It's starting and ending at Velocult. And this is also rolled into the zombie apocalypse ride from the Pathless Pedaled. I believe they are joining forces, and these two types
awesome.
Of disasters will be covered together. So,
and that does it for the mailbag.
That does it, yeah. Check out transportland.com. So, that does it for the headlines, sorry.
You're taking a lot of responsibility in owning and riding a bicycle. You are now an operator of a wheeled vehicle.
Should we hit that mail real quick while we're here? It's small.
Sure.
All right.
You've got mail.
Erica Shambion and Amaya Williams from World Biking Info, worldbiking.info. Pedaling to your podcasts makes the miles fly by. Thanks for all the cycling information and inspiration. You are welcome, Eric and Amaya.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. And actually, worldbiking.info, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they have a blog that features bicycle tourists from all over the globe, and they feature a new one kind of whenever they find one that is worth sharing. So Yeah, it's nice to actually make a connection with them. I had no idea they were listening. But yeah.
Let's do it.
Fantastic. well, hey, we should introduce you with some sort of fanfare. Would you like a traditional trumpet fanfare of some kind? Would you like a musical bed?
I'm giving away.
What sounds good? Oh.
I'll leave it up to you.
Okay,
guys.
Brandon
to
has
set the tone.
Yeah. We give you Ellie Blue.
Thank you very much.
Is that all right?
Much.
Okay.
Of Taking the Lane, takingthelane.com, Dinner and Bikes, and what else? Am I missing anything?
Oh, let's see.
Lots of things,
there's
I'm
PDX
sure.
by Bike. There's the Portland Society, and I'll just leave it at that for
all
now.
All right. Yeah, and the Portland Society, that was actually our connection with Ellie Talheimer, who came in last week. We thought about trying to get the power of two Ellies in one room at one time, but it just didn't work out, practically speaking. But that network is actually pretty cool too. So we should probably touch on that. Should we start with the tour that you've been on? Because you've been out of town for 7 weeks, you said.
Mm-hmm,
I thought it was 3 months, but maybe it just felt.
Where have you been?
It did feel that long. Let's see. Well, every year I go on tour with my partner Joe Beal, who makes documentary movies and also runs Microcosm Publishing. I noticed you have that sticker on your laptop. And also a chef named Joshua Plug, who is the traveling vegan chef and is a super talented guy living in L.A. So the last couple of years we've been on tour together. Last year we did the Western U.S. This year we did the South and the Midwest. So we took the train out to Kansas City, Missouri. We rented a car and we drove down through Texas, then down along the Gulf Coast over to Jacksonville, Florida, and then up and back through Virginia and the Carolinas.
Nice.
Tennessee.
That's a huge
Arkansas.
Circuit there.
It was a huge circuit. And we did 20 shows in about 30 days. We had some days off at the beginning and no days off at all at the end. And
wow.
We got to interact with people who are part of their local bike movement all over this part of the country, which mm-hmm. we don't really hear about very much
Certainly.
Here in Portland.
Yeah.
And
what were some cool things you heard about or met?
Oh, so many cool
Tell
things.
Tell me a story.
See what happens.
You know, it's some of the places that you least expect that have the coolest bike culture. Like, we were really blown away by the people in Mobile, Alabama, for instance.
Yeah, you know? I think you had a blog post about that. I don't remember the specifics at
us.
The moment, but yeah, what about Mobile was exciting?
I did recently post about it at takingthelane.com, so you can read a little more about it, but they have this thriving bike culture there that's got this very Portland flair to it, but none of it's imported at all from Portland. I think a guy moved there from Boulder and started some of it, but they've really made it their own, and so they have this group called Mobilians on Bikes that basically does fun social rides that aren't at all about exercise or recreation mm-hmm. or Lycra, but they are about like homebrewing beer and learning about urban chicken farming and
yeah.
touring each other's chicken coops and
That's
looking
in
at
our
public
wheelhouse.
Art and that kind of thing. So that was really, really cool to
yeah.
see. And, you know, it's the South and it's the Gulf Coast, so there's this kind of parade culture that's very like laid back and celebratory at
oh,
the
yeah.
same time, and bikes really fit into that perfectly.
Like every day is Mardi Gras, kind of, or could be?
A little
or
bit.
Or could become that way.
It wasn't as like party time in Mobile as it was in, say, Baton Rouge or
sure.
New Orleans all the time, but they
right.
definitely, it's very comfortable for them to like ride around in a group and kind of enjoy themselves on the streets. And they just
yeah.
really want a little bit more bike infrastructure to make them feel comfortable there. And
mm-hmm.
that's kind of all they need and all they want. And so I'm hoping that they'll be able to make that happen.
Yeah.
They seem pretty motivated.
It's very surprising because, like you say, this is not covered, especially in Portland. There is so much noise about bicycle happenings here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And when something does happen, it's like in New York or LA or something like that, you know, another big, big media city. And so, yeah, just the fact that this can happen, not off the grid, I guess, but out of the limelight and out of the places where you would expect to see it, that's kind of encouraging.
There's little things happening all over the place.
Right.
It's
amazing.
True.
It's so much more than we believe.
Right.
And we've seen it change every year. I mean, I've been on tour for 3 years now, and even in a few places we've gone back twice in a row, the bike culture has just grown so much. And everybody says the same thing. It's been in the last 3 or 4 years that mm-hmm. bikes have really started to take on. So there definitely is a nationwide revolution happening.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's very cool. It's just feeling that this is something like the possibility threshold is raising. That
mm-hmm.
It used to be I mean, I have a lot of respect for the critical mass organizations and you know, the rides that have been put together. But at the same time, the combative atmosphere that comes with some of that just kind of makes it, it reinforces the idea that that bicycling is tough and you have to fight your way. You have to carve out your niche.
Or it's us versus them when it's like, right. It can be all of us.
Right. And some of those things are certainly true, you know, either in whole or in part. But the idea that, like, for example, you can go out and have like a parade as opposed to a demonstration or as opposed to a...
Though in defense of critical mass, I mean, not everywhere has parade culture ready-made for
enough.
It.
And true enough.
Critical mass has also really been... you should have Joe on here to talk about this, but yeah. There have been some really interesting things that have happened in terms of police and the media branding critical mass really successfully as this aggressive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's documented...
When it's often the cops that are the aggressive ones.
Exactly. And there's even like examples where police informants are the ones riling people up kind of on purpose. So it's mm-hmm. been, you know...
Right.
It's been really, really well done. And critical mass, being a leaderless organization, has not really been on top of the news cycle in very mm-hmm. many places. So
true enough.
So there are places where critical mass is aggro. We were told in Houston that it's just, you know, really been taken over by some very aggressive people, but I've mm-hmm. I've never personally
by
been
and large
in...
it's been a predominantly positive, fun, hey mm-hmm. let's all ride our bikes together.
And when you ride on critical mass almost anywhere, the response you see overwhelmingly from people on the road, like in cars or walking down the street, is like they're thrilled, like they wave, they smile.
Right.
It's like
so
Sunday parkways without kids or a route. It's
exactly.
great.
It's this amazing anomalous thing. And for me, critical mass is how I got into bicycle activism. Like,
really?
I don't think I ever would have, I guess, felt, you know, I don't know if I ever would have seen an opportunity to like take a leadership role
right.
or organize things if it hadn't been for this venue where you, you know, anyone can go to the front of the ride and lead the ride. It's really
yeah.
empowering.
That's good. Look at you, busting cynicism left and right. That's fantastic.
That's right. I got to stick up for critical mass.
I apologize. This is one of those things that happens often on this show where I'm like, I have an
You're
opinion.
You're a
and
cynical man.
Again, and then I find out that I've just offended like everyone that came to tune in to listen to you.
Hey,
so,
that's what makes good radio, though. You got to have a little contention.
Yeah. That's right.
We
yeah.
can't just be high-fiving the entire time.
That is true. Little conflict here and there, yeah, without becoming Lars. So... Was this the critical mass thing? Was that here in Portland? Is that where
mm-hmm.
you kind of, yeah, yeah. Because it doesn't exist anymore, does it? Or does it?
I don't believe critical mass happens anymore in Portland.
Okay.
I tried to get it started again a few years ago
mm-hmm.
and every time, you know, I would show up and a few of my friends would grudgingly show up and then like there'd always be some guy who just moved to town who was like, I wanted to meet local bike people and I didn't know how else to do it. But
right.
There's only 9 of you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in Portland, there's a lot of ways to get involved in biking, but I've definitely heard from people who move here recently that they find they have a little trouble like cracking the barrier of getting into bike culture.
Mm.
And I think that's something critical mass offered that... it's a shame we don't have that here anymore,
right.
But it's still going strong in a lot of other cities.
Definitely. And well, and the thing about critical mass is that it is, it's a leaderless organization. No, it's not like an office. They don't have, necessarily a website. I mean, although they might, I suppose, but it's not like there's one person at the top saying, you know, and now tonight at midnight we ride.
It was the original
like
Occupy movement.
Sure. Yeah. Occupy the streets. Yeah.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I actually just wrote a chapter for a book about critical mass that was about the connections between critical mass and Occupy and
mm-hmm.
how critical mass really, I think, was what made a lot of us in the bike community who might otherwise be
mm-hmm.
a little less inclined to be sympathetic to the Occupy movement kind of really understand
mm-hmm.
what it was all about.
Right. And you have a common experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to be able to be like, okay, a lot of people are in this thing for their own reasons. It doesn't have to have a central message or unified organization
yep.
to be effective and
mm-hmm.
and fun.
And fun.
Yeah.
And what, change the world.
Yep.
It does seem like it, when you have kind of like the very simplest baseline you possibly can, when it's not adulterated by other political messages, it's not, it's basically just, hey, we are people on the street and we would like you to see us here.
Exactly.
And that that's kind of like the lowest common denominator you could possibly find with bicycles.
Exactly. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
While we're on the topic of Portland bike culture, do you have any perspectives you'd like to share on where planning and culture stands with bikes and transportation? Where
Portland?
To begin? Yeah.
Oh, man. It's hard to say. It seems like, I don't know. I mean, Portland really was in this super dynamic period of change really up until the last couple years as far as I can tell. And now it seems to be settling into something. And I can't quite tell the shape of what that is. But I do think that after traveling around the country and talking to other bike activists, I do think that... Portland has been exporting our ideas about bikes for a long time, and it might be time for us to start importing
a few other ideas,
and not just from Northern Europe. But
you mean we're not the smartest people in the world?
We've got something really special going on.
I could have sworn.
But I think it is up to us who love Portland and love biking to kind of keep the city's feet over the fire.
What are some cool ideas that we could learn from elsewhere?
Well, I was really inspired by our trip to Houston. And you might remember a few years ago, Portland had been the number one bike city in the U.S. for some time. And then Minneapolis came and dethroned us out of nowhere.
And people were pissed.
We were so surprised.
We had no idea. Up there. Are you kidding? Yeah.
But then, and you go to Minneapolis and you're like, why? Why is this so special? And I finally went to Minneapolis with a bike and biked around and learned that it's because they have this trail system. Mm-hmm. And I've been very skeptical about trails. I think in part because in Portland, we have so few of them. We have like the Springwater Corridor and it's narrow and there's too much traffic on it. But
generally
in Minneapolis, they're wide, they're built for transportation. They separate bicycling and walking. And that is, you know, and it connects the entire city, rich neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, and it gets you around the city fast. And then once you get off the trail, you can find a neighborhood route. And they've made that possible and fixed some of the worst connections. So I think that's really what built that there. And when we were in Houston, we were shown around by this guy named Tom McCasland, who swore Houston was going to be the next bike capital of the U.S. I wrote a blog post about this, too. And I was completely skeptical. I was like, what are you talking about? This place is terrible in every way. Like, they have no zoning, and they're basically run by oil corporations.
Sure. That's Texas for you.
But they have these bayous, and the city, the inner city is so depressed that basically the city's been able to buy up the land along the bayous, and they're building a trail system. They're getting it funded by a voter initiative, and they have the support of the oil companies because they have trouble hiring eager young people to come and live in Houston. So having anything to boost the quality of life is a good thing.
Yeah.
And come work for an oil company and ride your bike.
I know, right? And we met a lot of, I mean, young idealistic people want to do well in the world and they want to ride their bikes. So it's not that much of a contradiction. But and I really do believe, I mean, if they have a 500-mile network of trail systems that connects the entire city, they really could do it, especially if they're able to fix some of their surface street connections so you can still get around once you get off the trails. And I think that's something Portland hasn't built any new trails. You were looking at those maps on Bike Portland, and I think Jonathan did point out we haven't built new off-road trails in decades.
Right.
And like, we have this plan for the North Portland Greenway Trail, and we have this plan for an I-84 corridor, and why aren't we building those? Like, why is that not happening? It just seems like essential transportation connections that
definitely
we are just ignoring. So I think we could learn that from Houston.
Yeah. I was trying to remember, I think Mia Burke had that book that she put out about her experience with bicycle advocacy and changing the infrastructure and systems that we work on. And I think Houston was the one that she was talking about. A lot of those ideas sound familiar, but it's not clear enough in my mind to remember. But I think I remember just the fact that, you know, even a place like that can make radical changes to install bike lanes where it wasn't even thought possible.
And a lot of places that aren't bike friendly, they're not bike friendly because they hate bikes. They're they're not bike friendly because bikes aren't even on the radar. And I think it's easier to make change when bikes aren't contentious. So I think Portland has really like kind of crept into bike friendliness. And along with that, we've also crept into contention about bicycling. But for a city where it's not an issue, I think, and if they're willing to just do a lot of things at once, I think they can lay a lot of groundwork and create a bike-friendly city before that becomes something you have to fight about. So I wish Portland would have the confidence to just go for it.
You know, I was thinking just the idea about Portland's many cycling subcultures. It seems like it's so comfortable, I think, for many bicyclists to ride around town now that we've gotten to the point where it seems like it's easier for the cultures and subcultures to bifurcate and move against each other. And I'm probably one of the victims of this sort of mentality where, you know, now that I am not afraid of being hit like all the time as I'm out on the road and there is a bike lane for me. And I've been doing this for a couple of years. Now I'm comfortable enough to the point where I can start saying, well, you know, those damn fixies out there on the road, I hate those guys. Or like, yeah, those damn guys in Lycra, I hate those guys. You know, and I feel like if we were in a different position, kind
of guys in Lycra on fixies,
seriously, double damn those guys. Just the idea that you can, you know, in a place where you're less comfortable and you might seek more fraternal brotherhood with those riders or choose the another gender term that I can't think of right now. Just people feeling, you know,
ass kicking fellowship. No, fellow is gendered.
The warm fuzzies. that you feel between people who you might not be exactly the same as, but you know, but because of your position, you're kind of drawn together. And it seems like we're moving away from some of that in Portland. Did you think that's the case, or is there any?
I don't know. I mean, Portland, there definitely is kind of a. I mean, Bike Portland is one thing that creates this sort of big tent where a lot of people of those different sects of bicycling can come together and kind of work things out.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, there's contention everywhere. One thing that I was surprised to find in the South is there are still cities, including places like Tulsa and where else? Several cities we went to in the South that are currently slipping around my mind. St. Louis was another one. The vehicular cyclists are really actually quite powerful there and effective.
Yeah,
and
that's an interesting. Maybe we could define vehicular cycling just for people who
never heard that phrase.
Right.
For me.
So vehicular cycling is a philosophy promoted by a guy named John Forrester. He wrote a book about it called Effective Cycling. And it's basically an appealing philosophy that 95% is completely agreeable, which is that when you're riding a bike on the road, you're safest when you are basically treating it as a vehicle and following the same rules and enjoying the same rights. The problem with vehicular cycling is that other 5% where there are actually activists out there who will argue against any kind of bike infrastructure because people on bikes should be in the road with cars, even on a 40 or 50 mile road, even if they're 9, even if they're carrying groceries, even if they're 80.
Right.
And that the philosophy of these vehicular cycling advocates is basically like, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And they, John Forrester, who invented it, is currently actually on the Speaker's Bureau of an oil lobby group, automobile industry lobby group. Sorry. Yeah.
Whoa. Interesting.
And I mean, they're basically anti-bicycle advocates, but they call themselves bike advocates and they go to the city and they say, we're bike advocates and we want you to promote bicycling by not building bike lanes. And the city people who don't know anything about it are like, oh, great. Like,
that sounds great. Saves us money.
That's exactly what we want to hear. And so they often are actually very effective. And they're also, their tactic is to just kind of draw other bike advocates who really want good streets for cycling into these endless arguments that basically waste their time, create a false paradigm.
Yeah.
So we've only just started to get past that in the last 5 or 10 years and to having people like Mia Burke and who will go around the country and provide an alternative explanation confidently and loudly and without giving any credence to vehicularism has definitely been essential to changing the discussion. But we did find several cities in the South where that is still that's still an issue for some reason, and it just blows my mind. So we're lucky in Portland not to have that.
Certainly. Tulsa is just still in the grip then, huh?
Somewhat in the grip. And Tulsa is really one of those cities where biking is not super on the radar.
Right.
Most people who bike do it recreationally.
Mm-hmm.
But it could go either way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. I used to think I was a vehicular cyclist until I learned about that whole anti-infrastructure bit. And then I was like, you know, I'm not really a vehicular cyclist.
Yeah, and I call my blog Taking the Lane because for me, like, it was vehicular cycling again, where I was like, oh, if I ride in the middle of the lane and not skittering off to the side, I'm so much more comfortable. I'm better off. People treat me better. But then, yeah, I had to come to grips with the reality of, you know, roads that are built for cars.
Yeah.
Really suck to ride on, so maybe we can make this better.
Totally.
Create
foster
better
can
conditions.
Be pretty intense.
Oh, yeah. Foster.
We need to foster a safer culture.
But I mean, we need to create roads where we can go out and confidently take the lane on them and not have that be an option for everybody.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I think part of how we do that is we slow cars down to bike speed.
Yeah, for sure. That does seem like it kind of levels the playing field a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
The St. John's Bridge just got Sharrows, as I understand.
Really?
Which is a curious thing.
That's a great example of a misapplication of Sharrows.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
And I mean, I love the spirit behind it because nothing has changed in the law. The St. John's Bridge here in Portland is, it's probably, I would say, arguably the most beautiful bridge in town of all the ones that exist. It's this beautiful architecture. It's got the green sort of, it looks like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in some ways, maybe just because of the color. But it spans the Columbia River. That is the Columbia. No, the Willamette. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. There we go. From the St. John's neighborhood over to the west side, Forest Park and Linton and all those places. It was redesigned. It was, I think it changed from a two lane to a four lane when they kind of beefed it up some years back. And it's a big corridor for cargo and freight.
But it's got a good sized sidewalk on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's only a couple parts when you pass by the cable towers that you have to shimmy around those carefully, but right. Yeah, putting sheros on that is that for all the like Lycra folks that like to bike up around Savvy Island or something?
And that's kind of the question, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's a transportation corridor. I mean, if you're going anywhere on the northern west side, like the St. John's Bridge is your best bet, especially if you're coming from St.
Right.
John's.
Yeah,
to North
it's a choke
Portland.
Point.
And they really missed, they, I believe in 2005, there was an opportunity to put bike lanes on the St. John's Bridge,
right.
And that was not fought for effectively. Mm-hmm. By bicycle advocates, and it was shut down actively by other groups. I don't know the full story.
Well,
off
a lot
the
of
top
trucks
of
go
head.
Over that.
Yeah. Instead, you have trucks. What 10-foot lanes in each direction for vehicles that are like 8 or 9 feet wide, which doesn't leave a whole lot of room for wiggling about. So yeah.
No, and I mean, I don't know. It just seems it was a missed opportunity. You know, trucks could still have gone over if you had had bike lanes on there.
Right.
But they missed it, and now the sheros are kind of an attempt to go back and fix things, but
yeah.
It's not, sheros are for low traffic streets. They're for wayfinding,
mm-hmm.
and they're for like letting you know that you belong in the middle of the road and not on the edge. They're not for high traffic streets. Like they send the mixed message. They say, oh, this is a bike route. It's not a bike route. It's unless you're a vehicular cyclist.
Right.
Unless you're an oil lobbyist.
Or unless yeah. you're Jonathan Moss and his family going camping, because I think they did that not too long ago. It was sometime last spring or fall, or maybe don't remember
while
the
back.
Timing. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it is possible to be done. So, Brandon, you've got a stack of zines in your hand there.
Yes, I'm looking at Take the Lanes, Volume 4. And, well, I won't list them all, but tell me about these. I see a lot of them having topics of gender and bicycling.
Yeah.
Well,
what's up with that?
I'll let you know what a zine is first
yeah,
for anyone
go.
Listening who doesn't know. So I actually started publishing zines when I was 15, and then I took a break for a while. But they're basically like small pamphlets,
mm-hmm.
and they're usually photocopied with pretty DIY production values. When I started making them again a few years ago as an adult, I decided to try to make them with the production values as if I was publishing a book.
Right.
But without the binding, with the, you know, kind of the affordable printing and binding of stapling them.
Yeah.
And the reason behind that is because I was working as a freelance writer and I was also trying to get a book contract, and I was finding that the both of these fields are really ones that you have to kind of struggle to get by in,
mm-hmm.
and that when you are successful at them, you still have to work two or three times as hard as you did 10 years ago to do the same thing, mm-hmm. and still, you know, not make very much money or not necessarily enough to live on. So in a moment of, I guess, optimism or cynicism or both, I decided to start publishing my own things as zines, and I fund them on Kickstarter. So I'm able to afford the printing, and then I do all the design and layout and writing and editing and collecting contributions from other people. I either do that myself or I work with other people to do that. And they've been getting cooler and more complicated and with better submissions.
Right.
As time has gone by.
Yeah.
And when I go on tour, I sell these. And so they're $3 to $5 each, depending on which one. And the Taking the Lane ones are, the focus is on feminism and bicycling.
Mm-hmm.
It's often about gendered topics, but it's kind of evolving to be more about kind of a feminist kind of empowerment rather than overtly about gender.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, the best-selling one is called Our Bodies, Our Bikes.
Right, and that's right here on the top of the stack, I think.
It's tons of submissions about just kind of everything related to bodies and bicycling. That's my favorite one.
Yeah.
Everything from, you know, crotch health on the bike, which is an important topic.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Which
and
men
you've
talk
spoken,
about a lot. Women, mm-hmm. not so much.
Right, but yeah, you're one of the primary voices, I think, in this, if I remember.
By default, because no one talks about it, I suppose.
Didn't you do a reading at Powell's recently that was, I believe you read your one of your articles about specific to feminine concerns?
I did, yes.
Yes. I don't think I can say it. I was going to, but I think it probably would be either best from you or best just left to someone to research for themselves. But yeah.
Well, the article is called Your Vulva, and I wrote it along with
there
my friend who's a nurse.
Thank
and
you.
You know, you can read about men's crotch issues in the New York Times if you want in relation to bicycling, but there's not a lot of talk about women's health and, you know.
That's right.
There was just a prominent article, I don't remember where it came out, talking about a diminished sexual sensitivity in women.
I know, and like
based
WTF.
On the height of the handlebars.
Right.
This is the first time they've tried to figure out if the handlebar height has anything to do with both for men, ED issues, and women diminished sexual sensitivity.
There and I mean, go. I think it's great that they're even looking at women's health in that regard, but it's also like not very helpful to be like, bicycling hurts your sex life. It's,
yeah,
the opposite is true, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So there that, you go. And indeed. There's one of my favorite article in Our Bodies, Our Bikes, though, is by Katie Proctor.
Hey, there's an article. I just turned
mom.
To that here.
And she when she was in labor with her second child, she rode her bicycle to the birthing center while she was having contractions.
Yeah.
Holy
and she
crap.
Wrote about that
that's
and
awesome.
She tied it in with kind of her, you know, sense of gender issues in society in general, and it's awesome.
Yeah, did we talk to her about that when she came in? Because we had her on the show recently, but I don't remember.
I don't
if we,
remember that story.
She did so
I
many cool
have.
Things that it's hard to remember just exactly which in each individual. There's also this this entry here called My Butt, which is fantastic.
That's a really well-written essay by Nikki Robert, who used to be a Sprocket. And
oh, is that right?
It's all about how riding up hills in Seattle made her butt really awesome.
There we go.
Hey. I'm not doing it justice here, but
right.
You've got to read it. It's really, really well done.
Dig in. Yeah, these are all available at takingthelane.com.
Mm-hmm. Takingthelane.com/zines.
Yes, I was there earlier today.
Fabulous. And you can get some of them at Powell's also and at Microcosm.
Okay, yeah. So there's a Kickstarter campaign, Ellie. Tell us about this.
So I'm currently funding the 7th issue of my zine, Taking the Lane. I have a series of zines about feminism and bicycling called Taking the Lane, and then I also publish some other titles, but Taking the Lane is quarterly. I'm funding number 7. It's called Bike Sexuality.
That's right. This sounds intriguing.
It's not a topic I'm entirely comfortable with, and but I decided to go for it because it seemed to be what people wanted to write, and I got a lot of response about those parts of the Our Bodies, Our Bike zine. So I'm running a Kickstarter campaign to fund it right now, and you can find a link at takingthelane.com to put in your $5 to be one of the first people to get a copy and maybe some extra special goodies and help make it possible for me to print them.
There you go. So this is almost just like a pre-order system. I mean, Kickstarter is it's a fundraising sort of campaign, but you get a zine if you back it.
A zine and some other special goodies. I'm having some stickers made that
Ooh.
Will only be for Kickstarter funders. So,
nice.
You know, there's some perks.
Fantastic. I funded, I biked.
Exactly. Or actually, the stickers say proud bike sexual.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, from bike partisanship to bike sexuality. is there any sort of hint you can give us at this? You said it wasn't necessarily smutty.
Yeah, I thought it would be more smutty. I really did. But the only smutty things that I got submitted weren't really very feminist, unfortunately.
Okay.
I mean,
they fell down literarily.
Yeah, they were not like, they weren't really very down, let's just say.
Okay.
And I think it's possible to be feminist and smutty. It's extremely possible, but I don't know. I might actually take an extra few days in designing the zine and seek out some more content just
there
for all of you people out there who like bike smut. But
all of you perverts out there, we're pandering to you.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that goes. It might just be an interesting read that won't make you blush on the bus. We'll see. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world either.
Fantastic. I'm curious, just as far as gender, I mean, we probably don't have the time to give it the respect it deserves, but just to gender and bicycling, your thoughts broadly, like what are some of the forefront issues?
It's hard to say. There's a lot of talk right now about women in bicycling. How do we get more women to ride bikes? And you can't see on the radio, but I'm putting scare quotes around the word get.
Right.
There's kind of this like idea in bicycle advocacy in general, like that is, I think, one of the failings of bike advocacy. How do we get people to ride bikes? And when you look at the numbers and the statistics and the surveys and the research, you see people already want to ride bikes, but there are different barriers to bicycling that are just practical everyday things that whatever it is, whether it's like their body image or their, you know, household duties and childcare duties or not having a bike.
How do I do everyday transit trips?
Yeah. Not knowing how to ride a bike, not knowing that you can put cargo on your rear rack, not even knowing what a rear rack is. I mean, there's just so many, some of the, and barriers are different in each culture. Like, The CCC, the Community Cycling Center, recently has been working with a housing project in Cully, and they found that the main barrier to bicycling is everyone gets their bike stolen. So they're building secure bike parking up there.
There you go.
And so when you're thinking about how to like get people to ride bikes,
air quotes,
like it's a persuasion issue.
Yeah, you really, I mean, and a lot of people treat it as a persuasion issue, and that, I think, turns it into a guilt issue, which I think women are often more susceptible to, kind of feeling like we have the responsibility to save the world and run our entire households and do all the housework and work full-time and take care of the kids and ride bikes. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to see cycling become more equitable, then I think things are important, like looking at the division of paid and unpaid labor. You know, women make less doing the same jobs as men. Mm-hmm. And women also, there's some research recently that came out that shows that when you have a married couple, a man and a woman, and they both work full time, the woman tends to do one more hour of housework per day on average than the man.
Right.
And that's definitely a transportation issue. So, and I, so there are things we can do at home, and there are things we can do, you know, like, why don't we have maternity and paternity leave in this country? You know, that's a transportation issue too. What about school placement? There's just so many things. So that's, you know, and I think when you often you see couples have children, and that's when at least the woman stops bicycling, if not both of them.
That seems like it's a common story.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that I think have nothing to do with cycle chic or with, you know, hair. I mean, there is a double standard of appearance that I think is also a barrier to bicycling for a lot of women.
Yeah.
But
especially if you're into the coiffed styles.
Yes, exactly. Hairspray and the bike helmet don't go so well together. I wouldn't know, but I can imagine.
Indeed.
So yeah, I could probably go on for about 3 hours about this, but I'll just stop there.
Well, we'll have to, maybe we can set a date for that at some other point to explore it more fully. But
my South American dictator speech about women and bicycling.
That one will have alcohol on the show.
Well, thank you for coming in. Before we wrap up and let you go, maybe just a quick lightning round, a couple questions. I'll think of one, Brandon, then you come up with the next, and then we'll pass it back and forth for a couple rounds. Your favorite bicycling accessory?
Oh, my bell.
Really? Mm-hmm. Now, what do you like about your bell?
I like dinging it. It's a great way to say hello to people.
Ask a stupid question. Get an answer. That is very simple. That's good, though. It's amazing how useful that can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to and communicate, fun. Like, hey, I'm here, without being like, on your left, which sometimes can sound a little bit aggressive.
Or just to be like, hello.
Yeah.
That's
really
what I use it for more often when I see someone I know.
Right. Oh, hey, hang on. Just there it is. Those things are
Thank
great.
Thank you. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Brandon.
Tell me about a bicycle-based business, sort of like a Soup Cycle, that you saw in the South.
Bicycle-based business that I saw in the South.
Double alliteration.
Ooh, there is a soup delivery business in Atlanta, but I don't think I actually met them. There's a lot of like, there's a guy in Kansas City, Missouri, who's starting a bike messenger company, and he's trying to make it less like doing business deliveries and more like doing kind of restaurant or personal deliveries. And so he's been studying actually a lot of what people do in Portland and building his business, and he really has big plans for it. It's exciting to see. It's called Cowtown Careers, and his name's Rudy Gonzalez. So
Rudy Gonzalez,
you heard it here first.
That's fantastic. Nice. Biggest pet peeve on the road from other cyclists?
Pet peeve from other cyclists?
Unless you're not a pet peeve sort of person.
I'm not really.
You might be more zen than I am.
I don't know if I'm zen. I guess one of the things that bothers me most is something in myself, actually, and it's when I succumb to road rage, and if someone cuts me off and I give them the finger, which I'm very prone to do, and I try so hard not to do it, but I do it all the time anyway, and every time like somebody makes a mistake, and instead of then feeling apologetic or bad or just going about their day obliviously, then they feel like if I give them the finger, then they feel like they've just been in a contentious situation where they're in the right suddenly. Like it becomes,
I wasn't doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
They were in my lane.
That's a really good answer. So, that's good.
So I struggle with that continually in myself, but yes.
Nice.
Brandon. I as well. I've definitely yelled
me too.
Mean
yeah.
things.
And it can ruin your day to like react badly to somebody.
Right.
And even just in your own life, yep.
Question that will be really only relevant to Portlanders, but what's one connection here in Portland that you'd love to see be more bike-friendly? You find yourself getting on this road and damn it, this is the only...
Well, I lived for a little while in inner northeast Portland, and I have to say that, like, horrible vortex of doom around where MLK and the Banfield and 12th Avenue meet, like, there's just no good way to... in the I-5, ugh, it was causing me... I was really kind of stressed out for a while there in my life, and then finally I realized, oh, it's this intersection is so horrible.
Just go up the 20th, you're fine.
I don't know. 53rd is really the first place where I feel at all comfortable crossing the Banfield, but I do it every day anyway, so nice. What can you do?
Nice. Favorite Pedalpalooza ride that is not one you're necessarily leading?
Oh my God, they're all amazing. I think Splash Dance, the one where people bike around with mobile sound systems and then dance in fountains, that's the coolest Pedalpalooza ride I can
think
of.
That's a good idea.
They're all cool though, don't make me choose.
It's true, yeah. And so much good
What's
stuff.
What's the worst one? No, don't answer that.
The worst Bike Rats of Portland one that happened a few years ago, that was pretty bad.
Is that right? What happened?
Carl Larson led it, and he led it to, I didn't go on it because it sounded so terrible, but it was a way to explore the worst bike routes in Portland.
Oh, I remember hearing
to
about
ride
this.
Your bike. So I say that's the worst one, and with all complimentariness towards
not like,
Carl,
he
definitely achieved his goal, it sounds like.
Not like it was poorly led or like it was a bad concept.
Everybody who showed up.
Right, right. But it just unpleasant all the way around.
He wrote in the ride description that everyone was required to sign a waiver and write a letter to their mom before leaving.
Wow, that's intense. Brandon, last one?
Nope.
No,
I was totally thinking zero would be on the worst ones.
Okay. Well, do you have one, Ellie?
What's your favorite bike route in Portland?
Ooh, I really enjoy Clinton Street after it was repaved.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton Street before it was kind of a bone shaking sort of ride back in the day. The pavement was starting to fall apart, but they went back and they gave it fresh asphalt. They gave it Sharrow's, and I described it as the ice cream sundae for your tires.
Ah, yes. A little perspective is an amazing thing.
That's it.
Anytime I'm in a neighborhood or on a back street that I haven't been on before, I just stick to my same routes for so long. I worked in the middle of Portland and live out here, and so like went to a wedding up in Coley or something like that, and I got to see back streets that I'd never seen before. It's like, wow, this is so cool. And like just even going find a better way to get to the Fred Meyers on Foster and just go Woodstock and then up 80th.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And like there's all kinds of cool things you can see there, mm-hmm. including somebody has a big 8 foot tall Tom Peterson's head. Have you seen this?
No.
Go up 80th north of Woodstock.
Wow.
Seriously, it's amazing.
Right, and Tom Peterson was a...
and Gloria, too.
Furniture salesman, I believe.
Mattress salesman. Had obnoxious ads for decades here in Portland. Anyway, so jump off your normal route and try something different if you're really sick and numb to it all.
You may see a Tom Peterson head.
Another reason to enjoy your bike.
All right.
Find Tom Peterson's head.
Ellie, thank you again for coming in. It's takingthelane.com.
Yes.
Dinnerandbikes.com.
Yep.
And anything else?
The sprocketpodcast.com.
Thanks.
You guys?
That's right. Yeah. We'll get to that in just a
thanks
moment.
Thanks for having me on your show. This has been a lot of fun.
Fantastic. We are in fact at thesprocketpodcast.com. You can email us. It's thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. We want to know your stories, what you've been up to, what you'd like us to drink, who you'd like us to talk to, and many other things. You can email us. I just told you that. You can call us at 503-847-9774, or you can send us a text message, 503-847-9774. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. He's on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurt Bird for our headline sounder there at hurtbirdmusic.com. This has been the Sprocket Podcast. I'm Brock.
I'm Brandon.
That's Ellie.
Hi.
And we will see you on the morrow. Cheers.
Bye.
It's impressive. I don't know how he does it, you know?
I've seen him be in a bad mood before.
Okay.
Even then, it's not convincing.
It's one of those old fiddlesticks moments.
Exactly. Where he's like, I'm dissatisfied with the veracity of this claim.
This infographic is not sufficient.
Exactly. I need to spend some more time with my spreadsheets.
It needs more TriMet numbers.
Exactly.
Definitely. We just put this desk in here yesterday afternoon, so we're still kind of trying to figure out how how to work with its existence.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
What's the mission of the show?
Mission of the show...
vision or purpose or
yeah.
Summary statement.
It's really just an excuse to. It's like ritualized drinking with people who we think are cool and our friends.
There's
who
that
we may think are cool.
Right.